This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Mecklenburg County commissioners hear two consultants' reports analyzing problems at the health department with suggestions on how to fix them. Drama over Major League Soccer as private meetings with officials are canceled. The Senate version of the Republican health care bill sees changes. And we hear about reaction at a local town hall meeting about health care and impassioned remarks by CMPD Chief Kerr Putney and others at WFAE's public conversation on Charlotte's rising homicide count act to broaden the discussion. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. Tom Bullock is here from the WFAE newsroom, and Doss Helms is the education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Glenn Birkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. And we welcome Kirsten Garris for the first time. She's a government reporter for Spectrum News in Charlotte, raising her hands because we're also broadcasting on Facebook Live this morning. Welcome. Yes. You're a TV person, I can tell right away.
Welcome, what can I say?
Welcome to you. You can reach us through through Facebook on WFAE. Watch us on Facebook Live. You can reach us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. And of course, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Well, the two consultant organizations tasked with analyzing problems at the Mecklenburg County Health Department delivered their assessments to the County Commission this week, along with suggestions for change. They found a department that they described as poorly managed, with insufficient systems to track patient records. But Robert Kirk from the firm Navigant, one of those consulting firms, said all of the problems were fixable. What else did he have to say?
Well, It's going to cost about $1.5 million in order to fix those things, and that it's going to take months, if not, you know, upwards of a year to do it. And I'm not surprised that the consultants would come back and say everything is fixable. That's why they're there. That's why they're getting paid. What was more interesting to me is the litany of things that they found that needed to be fixed. Oh. And it's a pretty stark list. Inefficient patient access, inefficient records, clinicians, people who are supposed to be there to treat patients doing the work that should have devolved to assistants, and questions about management to the point. And this is one thing that, you know, it was definitely in a lot of reports, but I just really want to emphasize this, that they need to, the consultants suggested, reorganize the entire health department to the point where they would actually ask those people already in supervisory positions to have to reapply for the new jobs. Now, stop for a second and think about what that means. It's in consultant speak, I am willing to guess, and obviously I'm not a consultant. It means we don't have faith in the people you have running this department to the level that you need to have faith in them. They should have to reapply for new jobs so that way you can vet to make sure that they are actually in a position they should be.
Well, and I think that was pretty explicit, that the problems with management, which the county has been denying, were widespread, that there have been complaints about management and that these have shown to be true and not just an internal problem but an external problem, that you know, it's one thing to have people unhappy with their supervisors, to feel like they're being treated badly, but when you have problems that spill over into the way patients are treated, and then they are either not resolved or not responded to or even potentially kept away from the people who could change them, they are saying you need to clean house.
Well, we were talking just before this program began about how this has evolved over time. When this first came to light, I think in February, a lot of the people on commission were saying, nothing to see here. This is just a small little thing. It's not a big deal. Don't worry about it. It'll all blow over. And as details began to come out, it became apparent this is a very big deal here, mm-hmm. That this is not going to blow over. And District 2 Commissioner Vilma Leek said that the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Health Department has been a problem over the years in Mecklenburg County, so it did not just happen. All of this has been going on, she said, so our manager inherited a major problem that we are now trying to access and to do something about. And when she was on the program here yesterday, I asked County Manager Dina DiOrio if many of these problems arose due to Dr. Marcus Plesher's leadership or if they preceded him, and she confirmed Vilma Leek's take on this, that many of these problems came from a time when Carolina's healthcare system handed the department back to the county.
Had we been proactive and had the people in charge in 2013 been proactive in really trying to understand what we inherited, we could have probably fixed the problems much quicker. But the folks that were really in charge of bringing that back and working on that transition, I don't think did enough due diligence about what we were bringing back.
So why are we just getting to this now? Why hasn't this been known either to management within the health department itself or with the manager within the county itself?
Well, it's safe to say, I think, what happened in February with the incident with the 185 women not being notified about their abnormal passing results kind of was the straw that broke the camel's back. It said, okay, we have an issue. Let's start looking at what's going on. And now we're kind of delving deeper into, well, what are these issues that may have been festering for years, possibly, and no one really knew about it because nothing big had happened. And I think now that something big has happened, they're looking at, okay, what do we need to do to prevent this from happening again?
Glenn.
And I would point out as well that, in my opinion, the only reason we're here now is because of some very good reporting by the Charlotte Observer. This did not come about organically. This did not come about because the health department discovered these problems and on its own decided to make this public. The Charlotte Observer broke this story. The Charlotte Observer first told us about these problems. And I think a lot of these problems were known, but getting back, what was most eye-popping to me was something that the county manager said, that this is likely to get worse before it gets better.
Yep.
That's pretty scary.
One of the things, one of the suggestions by the consultants, there were two that Dina DiIorio seemed to latch onto pretty quickly and pretty strongly. One of them was outsourcing lab work to outside sources, and the other was better keeping and storage of patient information electronically. What did the consultants say about the current system? Because they are using electronic records. What did they say about the current system?
The current system is outdated, and some, I mean, they're
still
using paper.
Is the system, Kirsten, is the system outdated, or is it the fact that they're using it oddly? Because Dina mentioned yesterday that they're using it like an electronic file cabinet. They're just scanning documents in, and it goes into a file someplace, like a Word document. Is that part of the problem?
It's a combination of both. Like, they need to update some of their stuff, and they're probably using it in not probably the best way. But I know one thing that stood out to me is that they're still using some paper records. I know Navigant was also tasked with looking at the notification process for Pap smear results over the past several years, I think since they took over back in 2013, and they couldn't even do that yet because a lot of the information is still manual, like they have to manually input it. So I think it's a telltale sign that, there are a lot of technology issues they're dealing with that might be small on the surface, but again, since this has been going on for several years, it could now just be building up.
And you mentioned something, Tom, a minute ago, that people had to, the consultant suggested that some top managers reapply, have to be made to reapply for their jobs. Do we know how the county has reacted to that idea?
Well, I don't think we're actually going to get a full picture of that until they start the actual process of the suggested reorganization, if they decide to do that. I think it's pretty clear that they will walk down that line. How far they are willing to go, though, how much resources and time they're willing to put into it, those are the details that you always have to wait and see. But they need to do something. I just want to echo what Glenn said, and I think he is spot on. If it wasn't for the Observer's reporting, Plesha would still be the health director, and I think things would still be running exactly the way they have been. So now they know it. Now they can't just let it fester, and I believe that's basically what it was doing. So I think they'll pour the resources in, but again, it's how you do it. Let's go back to what Kirsten was just talking about with the electronic records. Like, just because you digitize a document does not make it it's an electronic record in name only. So is it a searchable database? Are patients being tracked? Are they being notified? Is the system actually set up to function to make it easier and faster to see patients and to make sure that their treatment and their diagnoses are actually relayed to the people they need to be relayed to? And, you know, when it's funny because, like, management sounds like such an easy thing to just – for a consultant to come in and say, fix – it's not just the people at the top. It's how they do it. They want to – the consultants are suggesting more managers, which makes it sound pretty top-heavy. But they're also saying they need to be in charge of managing fewer people to make sure these smaller teams work more efficiently. So eventually you get to the point where better patient outcomes are the result. That's the goal. Exactly how they – if they're willing to put all of the time and effort into that and to make sure that system runs, those are the details.
And ultimately you take this all the way up to the top and – the question is, does the board doing the oversight need to be replaced? The county commissioners, and we were talking about that before too, that the county commissioners who are generalists, who are not healthcare specialists, are in charge of this and missed a lot of things.
And I
think a lot of us don't understand. I don't understand medical record keeping. I don't understand clinical practices. So the question becomes, do they need a board of health? I mean, we have a huge, vibrant healthcare community here. It seems likely that we could find a board that would be a little more knowledgeable and might have not needed the newspaper to tell them they had a problem.
When I asked Dina DiIorio about that, because that was one of the commissioners, I think George Dunlop was the one that brought up maybe it's time to professionalize this with the Board of Health, she took it back to where they had taken this over from the clinics over from CMC, and she didn't know whether CMC or the other hospital system, Novant, would be interested in doing this. I'm not sure that's what we're talking about here.
No, I'm not talking about outsourcing. I'm talking about do you create a Board of Health,
right,
which would presumably not just be one entity. I think any entity gets vested in doing things the way they do things. And we were saying earlier, it's easy to dismiss an employee complaint. When an employee complains about a manager, sort of the default position is maybe that's a disgruntled employee. But if you – and there's no perfect system of oversight. I think every board system has missed things and been caught out. But this seems to be a problem that extends from the very bottom to the very top.
Yeah, it's also easy to dismiss, I think, patient complaints,
right,
about wait times and things like that, because everybody complains about having to go to a doctor and try to get an appointment in a timely fashion because doctors are slammed for the most part. But evidently wait times, just to do the paperwork for an initial visit, it could take almost an hour to have your paperwork handled, and then you'd have to go call many different phone numbers to find out where you were supposed to go or who you were supposed to see, and then there were multiple locations for these clinics, all of which has to be addressed. And Commissioner Pat Cotham spent some time at one of these clinics just to see how it all worked and said they need to be working on customer service. Is that likely to happen quickly?
I think if the commissioners push for it, it will. I know Pat Cotham has been one of the few saying she really wanted to hear from the community on this. She was like, because if you think about it, Navigant and Practice Partners, the two consultants, they talk to management, they talk to employees at the health department, but they didn't talk to patients, to my knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's what Commissioner Cotham says. She wants to hear from patients. How has your experience been? How has it been going? Because I think at least they want to, again, they want to fix this problem completely. They're here. They have to face it. I know a lot of commissioners said this is a wake-up call, so I think they want to do this right. I know we were talking about timing. It could take almost a year to fix these problems. I know Vilma Leek was like, kind of made the illusion that it might be that's too long, but Cotham said, no, that's actually pretty fast, because I think their whole thing is, if we do this, let's do it right.
It also is going to cost, they think, around $1.5 million. And I was actually surprised by this answer yesterday when I asked Dina DiIorio. I said, the county budget's billions of dollars, so $1.5 million seems like a drop in the bucket. No, she says that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of money, $1.5 million, sure, to the county. So given the price tag, are we likely to implement all of the suggestions that the consultants have put forth here, or pick and choose so it fits that figure?
I think it'll be interesting, because I think we're forgetting to mention, on top of all this stuff they have to revamp and restructure, they have to find a new health director,
mm-hmm,
on top of all that, and we don't know how much that will cost, and I think no one's factoring in that cost as well, because right now Gibby Harris, who actually is with Practice Partners, which is kind of interesting, one of the firms in kind of evaluating the department, she's now stepping in as interim health director. But I think that's one other thing they have to think about, is how much money they want to spend on that search, because since things may not have gone well with Dr. Plesha, who's the next voice to take on this department that you kind of want, I guess, in a sense, you probably want to have a fresh face, a fresh voice, because you're spending all this time and effort to evaluate it, figure out what to change. That's another thing they have to factor in, that I don't think we know the cost of that search yet.
And I have to say, if you don't mind, I really do have to think, a year and $1.5 million, that might be a lowball estimate in both ends, because you're talking about major revamp of an entire system.
Mm-hmm.
And if they try to do it piecemeal, if they don't try to do everything all at once, it could even get worse.
Speaking of drama, soccer. You don't need to have those in the same sentence, but we do, and we'll talk about that next. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Doctors Making House Calls. Physician-owned and managed, Doctors Making House Calls works to help complex patients stay healthy at home and avoid unnecessary ER visits and hospitalizations. Details available at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. And Charlotte Douglas International Airport, CLT Airport on Twitter, offers parking updates and travel tips during the busy summer season. Tips are available on Twitter at #CLTAirport. Russia's role in the presidential election remains center stage thanks to emails tweeted by Donald Trump Jr. The president's son has been asked to testify to a Senate committee as early as next week. Meanwhile, the first articles of impeachment against the president have been filed by a California Democrat, and Republicans are working to rework health care again. Though all of this is being eclipsed by Russia. We talk with political observers about this and more Monday on this program at 9.
I'm John Harwood. Coming up on the next On Point, Don Jr.'s emails, the FBI nominee refuses a loyalty pledge, the GOP struggles with health care. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The news roundup continues with On Point at 10 o'clock following Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Kirsten Garris joins us for the first time today on the news roundup. She's a government reporter for Spectrum News. Charlotte Ann Dawes Helms is here from the Charlotte Observer. Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. There was drama over something unexpected regarding Major League Soccer coming to town. It wasn't over money. It was over meetings, private meetings. MLS officials are coming to town, I believe it's next week they're coming.
Tuesday.
And they wanted to meet with commissioners and city council members. That meeting, and we don't know the genesis of this yet, but that meeting was supposed to be private behind closed doors. And I asked Dina DiIorio why.
We were told by the local soccer entity, MLS for CLT, that MLS was not interested in having public meetings. And so what we tried to do is we tried to schedule private meetings, whether it be one private meeting with four members or in small groups, to have them give them an opportunity to talk to the MLS officials. But our board decided the majority wanted to have a public meeting. And if that was not going to suit MLS, then, in fact, we went ahead and canceled the meeting.
Yes, and the majority of the board decided, she said, that they wanted a public meeting. But isn't it really the case that a private meeting with five or more commissioners is illegal in North Carolina?
Yes, which is why if they had done it, they would have done it in small groups. And that's not completely unheard of.
Right.
The school board has long had a practice of before their meetings, they meet in small groups with the superintendent to kind of pre-brief for the meeting. And I think certainly elected officials don't call a public meeting every time they get out and talk to somebody in the community. But this issue, it just became such a bad strategy to have the sense that this controversial issue was going to be discussed behind closed doors.
And the Observer talked about when I think county commission or city council or both went to New Jersey to look at the Giants stadium, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they made sure that they broke the big boards up into tiny groups for these tours so that they would not be colluding with each other. They wouldn't be meeting officially because it's
holding
against the law.
Holding an illegal meeting, right?
Yeah.
Because it has to be public.
Right.
Me. So there's some question about the genesis of the request for the private meeting. MLS says they didn't ask for it. The Charlotte organization said they didn't ask for it. Who asked for it?
That's going to be an interesting question, and I love Dina DiIorio's tweet from yesterday. The first thing it said, who done it? And that is what we're trying to figure out.
Yeah.
Who has done this? Because we went from just, oh, soccer's coming, okay, let's talk about it, to, well, who wants us to talk about soccer? Is it going to be behind closed doors or in front of people? We don't know, but it's interesting. I think who done it is the question that we're talking about versus who's going to pay for
it. Well, the MLS organization was quite emphatic about saying, no, we did not request this. Now, maybe they're being disingenuous and they requested it through MLS for CLT, the Bruton Smith group, but they gave this vague statement. It was one of my favorite paragraphs out of a story because the person who wrote the article said that the response was that they had participated in several public hearings and remains committed to open discussion throughout this process. And then the follow-up was, the statement did not answer the Observer's question,
yeah,
which was, did you request the private meetings?
Yeah, and I think let's take Dina DiIorio at her word here. I mean, she said she wasn't couching that. She said specifically who told her that this meeting should not be public. And again, if you have quorum, if you have the majority of any elected body in the state of North Carolina, they have to have that as a public meeting unless it is an executive session, and those sessions have very specific parameters to qualify. So she says it was MLS for CLT, the Burtons, right? Burton Smith.
So, at one point, if you're in a negotiation over money or the deal itself, who's going to contribute what? What's going to be provided to whom by whom? Don't you have to go into a closed session to talk about things that really are not the nuts and bolts aren't the public's business?
Contract negotiations are a legal reason to go into closed session.
But this was not a contract negotiation.
Okay.
Exactly.
That is a key point. That's one of those parameters I'm talking about.
Right.
And the one thing I found interesting, you bring up a great paragraph from The Observer. I agree. It was a great read. I want to bring up a great exchange with our reporter, David Borax, who was asking someone with the Burton Smith's group, the people who are trying to bring soccer here to Charlotte. And, you know, they say basically the MLS for CLT group says, oh, no, maybe this was a miscommunication. And I'll do the same thing. I will read here because I found this fascinating. He basically admits that opposition from some commissioners, a public meeting would not be a good idea. The reason, this is a quote, the reason was just to get MLS officials introduced to county officials, he said. And then David Borax asks, but could that have been done in a public meeting? Seems fair. If it's a meet and greet, you know, why not get a couple of photos? Doesn't seem like there needs to be anything too controversial. And the response he got was this. Unfortunately, given the position of some of the opposition, they have been very vocal, and you start having to schedule, and it just becomes very cumbersome and move beyond the scope of this supposed meet and greet. Okay. So think about what that statement's really saying. Like, is this a meet and greet? Is this supposed to be something else? Is this supposed to be a hard sell? Hmm. It's more than just a miscommunication.
Well, here, Commissioner Jim Puckett told WSOC-TV he agreed that any meeting about soccer should be public.
If you can't debate this in the public arena, you shouldn't expect the public to build you an arena. What is it you do not want the public to know?
And Matthew Reitenhauer and Pat Coffin, two other commissioners, tweeted similar opposition to this private meeting, but they and Dina DiOrio speak only for the county. What about the city? What about city council? Are they going to meet?
Apparently they are going to have a private meeting in the smaller groups. Again, as long as they don't have a quorum, it's not an official city council meeting. It's some city council members. And Ed Driggs said he's okay with that, that they want to get more information before they make a final decision. I think they've been still sort of wavering on this
because
commitment.
The county, correct me if I'm wrong, didn't the county vote months ago that they're in on this?
Yep.
They're ready to put some money toward this. It's the city that's so balking on
this. The city is the one that hasn't been as passionate about this. Soccer is a passionate sport. They have not been passionate about it. Back in January when this first really came up, it was quite clear city council was not on board with this. It was really one member, James Mitchell. He's their head of economic development. He has been a big soccer fan. But now, a couple months ago when they had a briefing from Ron Kimball on tourism dollars, that's when you saw council really warming up to the idea, and that's when they said, okay, let's talk about it in our committee. And the vibe I've gotten from city council members is they're not against soccer. They're trying to figure out how and when. And they felt like back in January it was rushed, and now they're like, okay, we'll talk about it, but we'll talk about it on our own time and in our own process. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't realize city council's process is slow and steady. So they're going to move soccer at their own time. I know county commissioners said they'll revisit the funding for soccer in August, but even then, even though they voted for it in January, they haven't said, we'll give you the money for it. It was actually taken off their capital improvement plan for the next 5 years. They said, oh, well, we have the money set aside, but we're not ready to allocate it quite yet to soccer. So there is probably a hard sell that has to be made to the county commissioners because they haven't given over that money yet.
And the city is even further behind in the process, as you just pointed out. So you just said, Anne, that you thought that they would have these small group meetings to stay within the boundaries of the guidelines set by North Carolina law. But the Observer reported earlier this week that the city has in the past been willing to skirt the state's open meeting law.
Sure.
So that's not going to happen this time.
Well, and I guess I'm not immediately conversant with that. I think they might be describing that as skirting the open meetings law.
Okay.
I don't think that they're saying that the city has just flat out broken the open meetings law, which would be to say, yeah, we're having a meeting at, you know, we're all going to get together at 6 o'clock at the council chambers and you can't come in, which would just be flat out illegal.
Yeah. And
I can't remember the exact example, but I think they may be coming close to saying exactly what you just said. I think there were some instances in the past where there were city council meetings that the Observer at least believed violated the open meetings rules.
Hmm. Well, let's change the last letter in MLS to MLB, Major League Baseball. During all of the conversations, and we had many, about bringing minor league baseball to Charlotte and building that stadium downtown, we kept hearing that bringing minor league baseball to town was our only shot in the Queen City of having any kind of baseball, that Charlotte was too small a city, too small a media market to have Major League Baseball. And so Major League Baseball would not be a concern for decades. Let's go ahead and build this minor league park. And the minor league park cannot be converted into a major league park. So imagine my surprise when I read on Wednesday that Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred named Charlotte as a possible expansion city. Did this come out of the clear blue sky, or have they been thinking about this for a while?
I'll be honest. He was not asked specifically, is Charlotte an expansion city? He listed it as a possible site unprompted.
Along with some world-class cities. I guess we've made it, Ann.
Right, Montreal, Mexico City, and Charlotte. So
exactly. Queen City's moving on up.
A list you don't normally hear.
Typically, when Charlotte has been mentioned as a Major League Baseball city, it's almost been kind of where a current team is holding its city hostage there, and they mentioned Charlotte as a possible place where we could go along with some other cities. This did feel a little different to have the commissioner out of nowhere put Charlotte into that league of possible cities.
Does that mean, Glenn, do you think that people have been putting the bug in his ear, people from Charlotte?
That's hard to tell.
Or we're just on the radar because of the Panthers and the success of the Knights downtown and the MLS bid, I think all of
that has to help. And when you look around, I mean, this is a very vibrant city. Is it vibrant enough to accommodate, 81 home games of baseball each year? I'm not so sure about that. I used to live in St. Pete where the Tampa Bay Devil Rays are.
The
Rays. And they struggled a long time, and I think they still struggle to get people in because it's a city that's kind of like Charlotte in a lot of ways.
And I'm really glad you bring up the Rays because one of the prerequisites the commissioner said had to happen before expansion hits is two teams, the Rays and the Oakland A's, need to get new stadium deals. So when you mention a city like Charlotte, you can also see it not necessarily as a promise that baseball is coming, but as a potential threat to the places that already have baseball. Think about this. Take Tampa. Tampa's a southern city. Charlotte's a southern city. Charlotte's actually growing faster than Tampa. We don't already have a Major League Baseball team, but we obviously show that we can support Major League franchises. And, you know, it's a wonderful way as like a bargaining chip to say, hey, potentially somebody could move there even if we don't expand.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Stadia. Because we have the Knights Stadium, we have the Panther Stadium, we have the arena for basketball. We're talking about building an MLS stadium. Can we afford another stadium? Because, you know, the Panthers are going to ask for a stadium soon. Mm-hmm. Soon.
Or major upgrades within the next, seven years?
And you know they will get it. It's the most valuable
franchise
in the world.
The cynics will say we can always afford another stadium.
So can we support that? And where would you put it?
Yeah, I think those are questions for, our city and county officials. I mean, that's going to be a big one because you're right. When you look around Charlotte, we have a stadium almost every 5 feet. It's like Starbucks. It's like stadium when you look at Charlotte. So where do you put it? And right now, if we're having all this discussion about a new stadium for soccer where they have a location, it's just a matter of upgrading it. I can't even imagine how the conversation is going to be when we say, well, we don't need to build a new stadium somewhere else. It'll be interesting.
And there's a very specific bucket of money that tends to go to these renovations, specifically with Bank of America Stadium and the Spectrum Center. That is the tourism tax, hotel tax. There's all kinds of different ways you call it. That's a bucket of money, and it is a pretty sizable bucket of money. However, it's very easy to drain that bucket of money when you're talking potentially like tens, if not more than $100 million of potential stadium renovations easily seen over the next, 15 years? Yep. It's easy. You're talking about building the soccer stadium. If the city actually ponied up, they'd probably take it from that money.
The Knights have been very successful since their move downtown from Fort Mill. Very successful. And a lot of that's marketing. A lot of that's the location of the ballpark, et cetera. But how much of it is that people here are happy with minor league baseball? They like the idea of it. They like the fun of it. They like the fact that they're seeing up-and-comers come into town and pass through town, et cetera, versus has that satisfied their desire for baseball? Or would they really rather see Major League Baseball?
Yeah, I guess it depends on whether you're a serious baseball fan versus an uptown event fan. Because I've gone to a number of the minor league games. I am not following it. But it's such a lovely setting. You're across from Romare Bearden Park. You're watching the sunset against the backdrop. Yeah. There are all these lovely restaurants and bars to walk to. So it's an experience probably that goes beyond baseball. And at that point, you don't care that much.
And then for the true baseball fans, I think you're right. They'd much rather see the major league, the big boys come into town. But that's the issue. As I said, there are 81 home games.
Mm-hmm.
81, correct?
Yep.
There are 81 home games each year. And that is a long schedule in the hot sun.
And most during weekdays.
Most during weekdays. And cities that have not reached a certain critical mass, they seem to have more trouble with baseball than any of the other sports.
Well, we spent a lot of time talking about something that when I brought this up before we started, Tom said, never going to happen. Is that my quote?
Well,
right?
No, you're not. I didn't say never going to happen.
Alternative facts here, maybe?
Yeah, exactly. I said not anytime soon.
Okay.
Not anytime soon. And I think that that is absolutely fair because, again, even the commissioner who just randomly says, hey, Charlotte, hi there, is not – like he has prerequisites. Yeah. And plus, then you have to do – I mean, think about how much time not just we have spent talking about the soccer stadium, but just – that is – think about the time the city and the county and everybody else has spent talking about soccer. And soccer is really popular. It's a growing sport. But if you think about the stadium cost overall, you're talking about, you know, a tiny fraction of a major league ballpark in a modern day. You bring in major league baseball, you know, whether it's moving a team or getting an expansion team and everything that has to happen for that to happen – it's years off, people. Yeah.
Well, last Friday during this program, we were 2 hours away from the opening of filing for becoming a candidate for mayor or city council or some other races around the area. And lo and behold, I think, Ann, you were there.
I was.
Tom was there at the election headquarters. And Jennifer Roberts, neither Jennifer Roberts nor her challengers, Vi Lyles or Joel Ford, chose to throw their hat into the ring that day. Kenny Smith, the Republican candidate, was there, but he didn't sign up that day. Why?
It's really simple. And if you think about it, it makes perfect sense. It is a zoo. On the first day of candidate filing, it is an absolute zoo. You have dozens of candidates that are there, and many of them, this is their one shot to be in front of a camera or a microphone, and they're there making their pitch, knowing this is their moment. They want to be known as, hey, I'm filed. We'll try to get the ball rolling. If you are a top-tier candidate in the biggest race on the ballot, arguably in the state this year, then you want the camera to yourself. You want the microphone to yourself. You want to fill the room with your own supporters and not have to share time with a bunch of other candidates. So they all space out their filings. So you first – you know, that was Friday. The following Tuesday, you had Vi Lyles file. The next day, Wednesday, you had Kenny Smith file. This today, actually, right after, you know, 2 hours after.
Joel
Ford's the only one left.
Joel Ford is the last one who hasn't filed quite yet.
Jennifer Roberts, Mayor Jennifer Roberts, filed on Thursday, and we believe Joel Ford is going to file on Tuesday next week because this
The opening day of filing kind of fun. I don't usually cover that. I was, you know, number three up with the other two on vacation, but it is just such a slice of Americana that you have local candidates, sometimes for their first run ever for office, and you have the balloons, and you have the cheerleaders, and you have the signs, and the relatives, and, you know, everybody taking selfies, and it really is kind of a fun little testament to democracy.
Are there any Russians lurking in the shadows? I'm just checking. When we come back, we'll talk about Joel Ford and Vi Lyles, because evidently they had lunch together, and we'll see if anything came out of that when we continue with the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Telware, servicing the Carolinas with unified voice data and video solutions since 1984, now offering hosted solutions for small businesses. More info at telware.com. And Charlotte Art League, presenting The Street with graffiti and street-themed art through July 28th, and Music, Laughter, and Art on July 21st, a paint-off event providing art materials for kids. Details at Charlotte Art League on Facebook. More smoke in the Russia investigation with the release of emails from Donald Trump Jr. The president's FBI director nominee says the Russia probe is not a witch hunt, as the president claims. And Senate Republicans are still behind the eight ball with their latest health care bill. Some of the stories they'll be talking about as the news roundup continues, with a look toward national and international news during On Point, coming up in just a few minutes with guest host John Harwood. And we will continue with our roundup right after this.
The never-ending cycle of breaking news alerts can make the world appear cluttered and confusing.
Premiums and deductibles for lower-income
market chains fell in the news of the Amazon Whole Foods deal.
Down to the meaning of one phrase, bona fide relationship.
That's why NPR is making space for clear, concise journalism and memorable stories. Make some space for yourself and stand with the facts. Listen every day.
At 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. The local news roundup, our roundtable of reporters has gathered. Glenn Berkins is here from QCityMetro.com. Kirsten Garris, government reporter for Spectrum Charlotte, Spectrum News Charlotte, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and from WFAE News, Tom Bullock. Filing for mayor and other races opened last Friday at noon. This is part of a two-week filing period. I think Joel Ford is left, the remaining major candidate who has yet to file, but
For mayor.
And he and Vi Lyles evidently met at the suggestion of someone else to talk about whether or not, ostensibly to talk about whether or not one of them should drop out of the race. What do we know about that meeting?
I can't even tell you what was on the menu. Not a whole lot, and that's by design. I'm still – this rumor, this idea – has been floating around now for weeks and weeks and weeks, more than a month, this idea that in order to defeat an incumbent mayor, Jennifer Roberts, in the Democratic primary, you may need to have a single African-American candidate on the ballot because the single largest Democratic voting bloc in Mecklenburg County are African-Americans. And Jennifer Roberts in 2015, when she first ran for mayor, did extremely well with African-Americans, and some people wondered – and she faced two African-American primary challenges at that time, both sitting city councilmen. They, you know, a lot of people wondered if they split the vote and therefore Jennifer Roberts can come in. I'm not exactly sure the numbers bear that out because she actually won precincts on her own right by significant margins. But, you know, I've been wondering – nobody is truly a candidate. They can raise all the money. They can make the yard signs. They can do whatever they want to do. But until they file that paper,
right. They
are not candidates, official candidates for a position.
If you want to look at this in terms of race, she's going to be a tough candidate anyway. She has a tremendous crossover appeal among certain African Americans in the African American community. She shows up to events in the community. You know, you could throw a birthday party in your home and I think that speaks well to her in a certain way.
Have so, cake and they will come.
So I think she's food. Going to be a very tough candidate anyway. If you put those two in there, I think she's a lock to get the nomination. It's just that simple.
But the question is she a lock to get the 40% or more that she needs to avoid a runoff? Because that's one other way that it happens
is
that the voters decide between Vi Lyles and Joel Ford, and one of them ends up in a runoff with Jennifer Roberts.
And I also think, too, that this is a tricky conversation to have because I think it's a disservice – I know it's a disservice to the African-American voting community because, frankly – it's assuming that African Americans vote primarily on what a candidate looks like and not an issue that the candidate stands for. And I just don't think that's realistic.
And I think Jennifer Roberts actually gives the lie to that. And that's the point I was trying to make. She does have tremendous appeal in the African American community. I think just a one-on-one with her or one of the other candidates, she would fare very well in the African-American community.
I think we also have to mention that there are some other lesser-known candidates running for mayor on the Democratic side that could take away a few votes. I mean, granted, it's not going to be a lot, but we're talking about a non-presidential year where getting voter turnout is almost impossible. I think when Mayor Roberts ran in 2015, it was like 9% showed up in the primary.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. That's a lot. And we're talking about 9% of voters. And it'll be interesting to see if maybe all these millennial candidates, if they can bring out their base, if because there are so many African Americans from mayor to, again, all of these districts, maybe that will bring people out. I think that's a question that obviously time will tell, but it'll be interesting to see if that does anything.
Well, shifting our attention briefly here to Washington, yesterday the U.S. Senate unveiled their new proposal to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, or in some cases maybe just supplement the Affordable Care Act by revising their bill to help hold down insurance costs for consumers while keeping a pair of taxes on high-income people that they had originally planned to eliminate. But Susan Collins of Maine and Rand Paul of Kentucky immediately announced their displeasure, so they cannot lose any more Republican votes in the Senate to make this pass. Mm-hmm. But before that plan became public, 12th District Congresswoman Alma Adams held a town hall meeting here on health care. Who was there? What was the mood in the room? Anybody know what the constituents were saying about health care?
Well, I didn't cover this, but our colleague Mike Alex Olgan did, and it's pretty much what you would expect. I mean, that's the thing here. First of all, let's note that this is in the Senate, so we're going to talk about a bunch of representatives. They don't have a direct role in this right now.
Right.
Subset of that are Democrats who, regardless of which chamber you've been in, you've had no role in this at all. So,
and you probably like Obamacare in many cases.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So you have 12th District Congresswoman Alma Adams standing in front of arguably a pretty friendly crowd to argue that what we need to do is fix mm-hmm. the problems with Obamacare instead of throwing it out and trying to get something new in.
I didn't attend that either. I understand there were about 200 people in attendance at that event. I think she used the word heartless to describe the Senate
yes.
bill. Because I can't remember the number, but it was she predicted that more than 100,000 people in her district.
Close to 150,000.
Yeah, about 150,000 people in her district alone could lose coverage if that particular bill made it into law.
Yeah, she said the loss of coverage is a death sentence for some and bankruptcy court for those lucky enough to survive. So,
and Congressman Robert
that's pretty Pitten, strong language.
Yeah. Congressman Robert Pittenger, the Republican from the 10th District, said that Obamacare is collapsing and that what we want to do is provide health care that's not federally mandated. He participated in a roundtable discussion for the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce. How did that go? Anybody know?
I think it's fair to say it went just the opposite of
yeah. another friendly
audience. Maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. On Tuesday night, WFAE held a Charlotte Talks public conversation on the rising homicide count in Charlotte. CMPD Chief Kerr Putney said that you have to look at social, economic, and education opportunities. You have people who are devoid of hope and who are frustrated. And he said that these people, most of whom are young, between 18 and 34, these people are being failed.
It's us as adults failing these people. It's us failing these people. It's the truth. It's a humanity issue. It's a parenting issue. It's a role modeling issue. It's not a system or a program. I'm sorry. Government's not going to save us. Another program's not going to save us. We have to save ourselves, and we have to do so by putting our actions behind our words.
He was pretty passionate, and he was also passionately blunt about the need to create social mobility opportunities. And if I understood him correctly, and I hope I do here, he says we need a changing of the guard in terms of who gets to help the people who need that help.
We're going to have people who have a lot of influence give up some of this authority and power and allow some people who don't to have a seat at the table, as a brother said. And that's simple. I'm not asking you to tutor or spend time with kids that you're afraid of. What I am asking you to do is fund those who are willing to do the work to do it for the people that you might be afraid of. I'm not going to say come by Yah and let's overcome everything. What I'm going to say is if you have financial means, support the work that needs to be done that changes these outcomes. And then you get out of the way and shut your mouth. And let those of us who are willing to change outcomes do so.
Wow.
Yeah, I think that was a moment when a lot of ears pricked up.
Yeah. Who's he talking about getting out of the way and letting us do the job?
I think he's referring to this concept that I believe we've discussed before of kind of paternalistic charity, mm-hmm. that those of us who have had a lot of paths to a safe, stable, prosperous life and who would have almost have to work to get onto the path of crime and poverty make judgments about the people who have. And I think if you are black growing up in America, specific policy decisions have thrown up obstacles to that safe stable, prosperous life from housing policy to education policy. And meanwhile, we're paving superhighways to prison for a lot of people.
He's the guy with street cred on this because he grew up in a situation not unlike the kids we're talking about here, and he did not like the police when he was a child for all the obvious reasons, and now he's the chief of police. Both of you, Ann and Tom, were there, and Glenn, I want to hear from you, definitely, Glenn, but both Ann and Tom were here. Do you find what he had to say that night remarkably outspoken for a public official?
Absolutely. And I think it's powerful, too, because I think one demographic that we haven't mentioned yet that he's talking about there are, regardless of race, rich people who think that this is not their issue. They can look at the numbers, they can think about the statistics, and they can say, that's really not good. I wish there was something we can do about it. He's saying, okay, get off the sidelines. You don't want to come down here. You don't feel safe. Fine. Plunk your money down. Get out of the way. And that bluntness was throughout the entire night. I think it just shows a chief of police who is, you know, you can argue whether or not he has been overly criticized or not criticized enough. You can talk about his relationship with the mayor and the city council. You talk about a number of factors. But it's pretty clear to me that Chief Kerr Putney is just simply decided, I'm going to face flack no matter what happens. So you know what? I'm going to be the chief that I'm going to be. We'll see what happens.
Well, good for him.
I think his message was slightly different. I look at Charlotte as a very, very generous city. We have a lot of rich people who are plunking down their money. We have a lot of rich organizations and companies that are putting money behind these efforts. But as Ann said, we're very paternalistic in our generosity. We are not empowering the people we're trying to help, and I think that's the problem.
How would we do that?
Well, go to them and let them figure out, back their efforts. Don't go into communities with your plan. And we're doing that, whether it's efforts to increase reading or Project Lift or economic mobility. The people who are sitting at the table deciding what that program will look like look nothing like the people they're trying to help. Mm. And I wonder what kinds of programs we would have if those who have means were willing to put that money into true economic and social empowerment in those communities.
The chief did thank Bank of America and Hugh McColl specifically and said there were other institutions that have also been equally generous. I didn't want to just include them, but that's what came to mind at the moment. But he also made a point of saying certain organizations, and I think Wells Fargo is one of these, hire people, please. Hire people. Hire these people who need a leg up towards social mobility because that works. You think that message will be heard?
It might be. I mean, that Opportunity Task Force report was also sobering. I mean, it says Charlotte's not doing well. So, I mean, I think people are listening to that and trying to find ways to turn the tides around with that because, I mean, Charlotte's last, and that's not a place people want us to be.
One of the most remarkable voices on Tuesday night, to me at least, was Gemini Boyd. Mm.
Yes.
He's a community activist. He's the CEO of something called Project Bolt, which helps young people helps people who need a leg up. And he's a guy who just, I think, 2 weeks ago finished serving a 20-year prison sentence. And he said things about these young people in these neighborhoods that I think most people don't, unless you're in those neighborhoods, most people don't understand. He said that years of the war on drugs, years of this get tough on crime attitude have left these young people unafraid of law enforcement. They see being cuffed and carted off to jail as a badge of honor and prison as a place they are supposed to be. It's amazing. He's been out of prison, I'm told, for 14 months now. But nonetheless, that's an amazing quote.
And it was so powerful to hear from him because people like I have for most of my life felt like people who are criminals, you know, who have been to prison, who have a record, are just kind of outside the pale. And that is what employers tend to think. And that's a hard mindset, you know, that if one job candidate has a clean record and the other has a record and it's a drug-related record, do you want that person? But what he's saying is that whole communities have been swept up, and honestly, if everybody that I knew who had any kind of connection to ever using drugs or being around people who did were labeled with that label, our our generation would have a very different prospect. So
there was one speaker there that, and I don't know who he was, but I did hear him speak, and I think he summed it up. He basically said to the African-American community, if we're going to fix these problems, we have to fix them ourselves. There's not some hero who's going to march in and fix it. It's not going to be fixed by the government or some program. And he's absolutely right. I don't know how we get from where we are to where we need to be. Mm-hmm. But we've had generations of programs and social engineering and whatever. At the end of the day, these are problems that the African-American community has to tackle head on.
So one more thing I want to talk about today, and that is the tweets from Donald Trump Jr. this week that essentially it was the email stream that led to him meeting with a Russian lawyer who may or may not have connections with the Kremlin, and the reaction of North Carolina legislators about all this, or at least lawmakers. Senator Richard Burr, who chairs the Intelligence Committee, said that they are looking into the Russian connection, and he warned against forming any conclusion based on an email release. And when asked by reporters as he was getting into an elevator about whether he would like to have Donald Trump Jr. testify before his committee, his response was, see ya. He will be testifying before the Judicial Committee. But we did hear from Senator Tom Tillis.
It has nothing to do with what we need to get done in August. You know, the process is going to follow out. And we'll let the committees of jurisdiction or the appropriate folks in Department of Justice sort that out. But that's the very thing that we need to not be distracted by. We've got to come up with a health care outcome. We've got to come up with a tax plan. We've got to come up with a spending strategy. And we've got to be disciplined and not get distracted by things that may be legitimate, but not right now in our lanes.
And Robert Pittenger and others had expressed similar frustration. How serious is this email string? Very quickly.
Very. President Donald Trump cannot call it fake news. It came from his son. It implies directly the hint of collusion, if not certainly a willingness to do the act itself. And I have to give a shout out to Senator Tom Tillis, because I'm willing to bet that he is not the only Republican when it comes to a tweet from any member of the Trump family that they would all love to say, this is not what we need to be dealing with right now.
Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and Kirsten Garrett, her debut government reporter for Spectrum News Charlotte. Thank you all.